all right at the heart of the apparatus that made Saddam's rule possible, and until now, impregnable. Holy shit, Saul muttered. If it is 50% bullshit, we've still hit a gold mine. The television monitor had a small but highly unusual warning in the corner of the screen. Top secret. The man sitting at a table in the studio on October 18th before a large old-fashioned microphone a la Larry King was short and balding. He wore 3 stars, the rank of lieutenant general, and spoke in an insistent, high-pitched voice, both brainy and confident. A large banner strung behind him said, "Talk NSA." The NSA was for National Security Agency, the inner sanctum of intelligence secrets, which intercepts communications abroad while trying to protect U.S. codes and break foreign ones. NSA targets were telephones, radios, computers, banking transactions, and almost any electron that moved. All this is called signals intelligence, SIGINT in the spy world. Though it is unknown to the outside world, NSA has its own talk show. Talk NSA is broadcast on the secure, top-secret closed television circuit to some 32,000 employees at NSA and no one else. Speaking that day was Air Force Lieutenant General Michael V. Hayden, the director of NSA, who had spent 32 years as an intelligence officer with assignments in Europe, Asia, and throughout the Pacific. Turning to the possible war with Iraq, Hayden had decided to lay it on the line for his workforce, saying something that could not be declared publicly. "A SIGINT agency can't wait for the political decision," he said. Although a formal decision to go to war with Iraq had not yet been made, every instinct and experience told him that war was coming. He had to move resources. Given the weather in Iraq and the requirement that the U.S. forces would have to wear chemical protective gear, he said, "You can't start a war in Iraq later than March." That was less than 6 months away. "You've got to do it in January, February, or March." Hayden's declaration would have created a sensation if it had leaked to the news media. Like nearly all of NSA's secrets, however, it did not leak. Hayden was not going to be caught short as he had before 9/11. In important respects, it had been a very bad year for NSA. There was an expectation in the United States, driven by the media, the Congress, even the TV and movie culture, that the country's lead in high technology and investment in its intelligence agencies would provide warning of an attack, even a terrorist strike such as 9/11. Hayden had been getting ready for Iraq much of the year. The first alert for him had been the president's Axis of Evil speech. The declaration had an unusual clarity and likely meant war, Hayden had concluded. With his subordinates, he had gone further. "It is my judgment in doing this for more than 30 years, I have never seen a condition like this when it didn't end in war. We're going to war." On July 31st, Hayden had NSA conduct a rock drill, an old army term from the days when a planning exercise consisted of moving around rocks on a map to signify formations. He gathered together all the SIGINT producers who managed the actual listeners and asked how they would tackle Iraq as a wartime target. He was going to have a wartime target list in the hundreds, meaning the NSA would not only try to intercept the senior Iraqi civilian and military leadership, but drill down into smaller military, intelligence, and security units. Hayden knew that SIGINT did not get better with time. It got worse and eventually grew useless. Its value was its immediacy, and he was going to make sure they could give it to the people on the battlefield. He would set up a highly classified computer chat room that would link the NSA operators, listeners, other intelligence personnel, and military units directly. Its code word was Zircon Chat. The network could handle up to 2,000 people all linked real time, so an intercept, say, of an Iraqi colonel could be available to the U.S. military on the battlefield. The information could be used to track the Iraqi unit or attack the colonel. Hayden had a dark view of the world. He didn't think it would be possible to preserve the United States as a free society as they knew it by playing defense on the 3-yard line all the time. They had to play offense. Still, he believed the targets had to be of sufficient weight to justify the potential loss of innocent life. Hayden had reviewed NSA's substantial take from Iraq on Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, the accumulated evidence of programs and concealment. Massive but inferential, he concluded. The only parallax that brought all the data points together was the conclusion that Saddam had a hidden WMD program. But it was not a certainty. One night as he was doing the dishes with his wife, she asked about this and he said, "If it were a fact, it wouldn't be intelligence." Powell realized that he, the president, and perhaps the rest of the world were traveling a road that would come to a fork. One fork would be a new UN resolution, weapons inspection, and no war. The other fork would be war. It seemed almost that simple. To win a new resolution under UN rules, Powell had to get the votes of 9 of the 15 Security Council members. France, Russia, and China all had close commercial ties to Iraq and had come out publicly against any unilateral U.S. action to depose Saddam. As Powell met with his counterparts and burned up the phone lines, he saw that French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin, a tall, aristocratic poet diplomat who had written an adulatory biography of Napoleon, held the strongest feelings against war. Meanwhile, Cheney insisted that the resolution require Saddam to submit a detailed declaration after a resolution was passed. Iraq would have to give a full accounting of all programs to develop chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. Saddam would be given 30 days to do this under Cheney's proposal. It was designed more or less as a trap for Saddam. He would claim he had no WMD, and that lie would be grounds for war. Or Saddam would confess he had WMD, proving he had lied for 12 years. As Cheney framed it, that would be sufficient cause to say he's lied again, he's not come clean, and you'd find material breach, and away you'd go. Rice and the others thought it was a brilliant idea, and Powell was asked to sell it to the French, who eventually agreed that the resolution could require such a declaration. De Villepin, however, continued to insist that a second resolution would have to be passed to authorize war. Bush and Cheney deemed that unacceptable. It would ensure delay, and a second resolution would be harder to get than the one they were negotiating. It got so tight and so tense that the final disagreement boiled down to the use of a single word. The French position was that a false declaration and a general failure to cooperate could constitute a material breach. The "and" meant Saddam would have to fail 2 tests. Powell's draft said a false declaration or a general failure to cooperate could constitute a material breach. De Villepin wouldn't budge. On November 1st, Powell brought the people who would head the UN weapons inspection teams to see Bush and Cheney. Rice and Wolfowitz also attended. They were Hans Blix, a cheery 74-year-old Swedish lawyer and diplomat who wore dark-rimmed glasses that dominated his large face, and Mohamed El Baradei, 60, the Egyptian director of the Vienna-based International Atomic Energy Agency, which verifies nuclear non-proliferation. The view among the hardliners, including Wolfowitz, was that Blix was weak and would be pushed around by Saddam. "You've got to understand, Mr. Blix," Bush said. "You've got the force of the United States behind you, and I'm prepared to use it if need be to enforce this resolution." The president added, "The decision to go to war will be my decision. Don't ever feel like what you're saying is making the decision." Blix, who had taken over the Iraq Weapons Inspection Commission in 2000, and previously had headed the International Atomic Energy Agency for 17 years, said he wanted tough inspections, knew the game Saddam played, and was determined this time to get to the bottom. Bush seemed somewhat convinced, though Cheney was concerned that Blix, from traditionally pacifist Sweden, would not be tough enough. The French intransigence surprised Powell. The art of a successful negotiation is often to find an endgame in which it gets down to a single issue, in this case, and versus or, and then to capitulate. Powell talked to Rice and said he thought he could get 14 votes of the 15 on the Security Council, perhaps even all 15 if he could give in to the French on the and. Rice called around to the principals and the president. All wanted to stick with the or, so Saddam's WMD declaration would be all they would need for war. "It isn't worth it," Rice finally said. Whatever the language in the resolution, they would be in the Security Council arguing over Saddam's weapons declaration anyway. Let's not hang on ceremony here. Powell finally received the final okay from Rice. He called de Villepin, who was on an airplane with Chirac. "Dominique, we can go with Anne, but only if that's the end of it. There is nothing else to discuss. It is over. And I have to have your approval of that and your president's approval." "The president is sitting right here with me," de Villepin said. "I will ask him. I think this is it." "Yes," de Villepin finally said. "Yes." "Wonderful," Powell replied. "That's a deal with you." He immediately called the Russian foreign minister, Igor Ivanov. "Igor, I just made a deal with Dominique, and it's going to be and." "That is a major breakthrough," Ivanov said. "How wonderful. I must hang up and go see the president immediately." He apparently rushed off to talk with Vladimir Putin. Ivanov called back a half hour later. "Putin approved. It is wonderful. It is a breakthrough." No, Powell realized, it wasn't. The seeming compromise was just getting everybody off the hook. But hey, he thought to himself, you take it where you can get it. On November 8th, UN Security Council Resolution 1441 was brought to a vote by the 15 representatives seated around the dramatic circular table. All 15 hands went up. The biggest surprise was Syria. It was read as an important signal of Arab displeasure with Saddam. Well done, Bush said in a call to Powell. Powell knew he had scored a big victory. He had made diplomacy relevant. For his larger, ultimate purposes of avoiding war, however, he may have done too well with the resolution. Later, President Bush recalled that it had been a very difficult time. He had worried about the negotiating strategy. "I felt like the French were getting the upper hand. In the end, we got a great resolution, and to Colin's credit." He recalled his attitude. "I am very frustrated with the resolution process. The campaign is happening at the same time." The midterm elections were November 5th. Historically, the party that holds the White House loses seats in the House and Senate, often many. But the Republicans gained 2 seats in the Senate, putting them back in the majority, and added 6 in the House. "We win the elections and win the resolution," Bush recalled. But he said he had a more ambitious goal, which was a very intrusive inspection regime, which Blair and I both were hoping would cause there to be crumbling within the regime. On Friday, November 15th, the Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, came to the Oval Office to see the president. Cheney and Rice were also there. Bandar handed the president a private letter from Crown Prince Abdullah, handwritten in Arabic, and provided an English translation. In part, it said, "My dear friend George Bush, there are many things I wish we had an opportunity to discuss face to face, but the most important ones I have asked my ambassador to discuss with you." As instructed, Bandar then said formally, "Since 1994, we have been in constant contact and touch with you on the highest level regarding what needs to be done with Iraq and the Iraqi regime. Throughout this time, we were looking for seriousness from you that should have been demonstrated in coming together for formulating a joint plan between the governments to get rid of Saddam. Now, Mr. President, we want to hear from you directly. If you have a serious intention, we will not hesitate in giving you the right facilities that our 2 military people can then implement and discuss in order to support the American military action or campaign." Bush replied, "If I decide to deal militarily with the situation in Iraq, It will mean the end of the current regime, nothing short of that. The president said he wanted to create a new Iraqi government that represented all the different religious and ethnic factions of Iraq. The main goal is not really the return of inspectors to Iraq, but to make sure that Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction that could pose a threat to the kingdom and/or to Israel. Bush added that when he made up his mind on the military option, he would contact the crown prince prior to his final decision. Bush also said he would like to reiterate his government's commitment to the peace process, regardless of what the Prime Minister of Israel or others around him might say about the Americans' view or position. Bush went on to criticize Yasser Arafat, saying the current Palestinian leadership was not useful. Alternative leadership was needed, he said. Such leadership will emerge if an opportunity is given to the Palestinian people. He also criticized the Israel leadership. Sharon is a bull, he said, and the alternatives are worse than him. The president added, changes in Iraq will result in a change of way of doing things, not only in Iraq, but even in Iran. Cheney asked what the Saudis wanted to be said publicly. We would like everything to be kept confidential and secret between us until further notice, Bandar replied. Bush then asked to see Bandar alone, and they met without the others for 15 minutes. On Tuesday, November 26th, 2 days before Thanksgiving, General Franks sent Rumsfeld what Franks called the mother of all deployment orders because it was a giant request. Almost exactly a year earlier, the president had asked Rumsfeld to begin serious work on the Iraq war plan. This was a first major step in implementing what they had done. Franks was requesting that Rumsfeld begin deployment of 300,000 men and women. Franks told the president it was what he would need if you want to start the war on pick your date in January, February, or March. After blanching, Rumsfeld said, "We can't do it this way." Diplomacy would be over. Bush made it clear that he did not want a deployment to limit his options. Dissociate a big deployment or build-up from what Colin is doing on the diplomatic front, Bush instructed. Iraq had agreed to new weapons inspections that were starting the next day. He was increasingly skeptical, but he could not appear to be pulling the plug. "Don't make it look like I have no choice but to invade," he said. Rumsfeld said they had to find another way to begin the process. "We're going to dribble this out slowly," he said, "so that it's enough to keep the pressure on for the diplomacy, but not so much as to discredit the diplomacy." Frank said the war would be over sooner if he could get the forces there quickly. "It wasn't going to happen that way," Rumsfeld said. The first major deployment order was issued on December 6th. It was going to be slow, and Rumsfeld would have to approve each deployment order, perhaps two a week, for a long time. There was a good deal of grumbling, especially from some army generals. Rumsfeld later recalled, "The fact that it took the deployment process and disaggregated it to support diplomacy was never understood out there, and I didn't want to say that's what we were doing, so we sat here and took the hit." The wisdom of insisting that Saddam make a full and early weapons declaration 30 days after the UN resolution was passed seemed evident. He was boxed in, it seemed. Weapons inspections on the ground in Iraq had begun in late November as the UN teams traversed the outskirts of Baghdad in their white vehicles. Nothing was found even in a surprise 1.5-hour search of one of Saddam's presidential palaces. On December 7th, Iraq submitted an 11,807-page weapons declaration that said it demonstrated and proved that it had no weapons of mass destruction. Cheney proposed to the National Security Council that the president declare it a material breach since the declaration was clearly false, he said, and proved Saddam had lied once again. "It should be grounds for war," he said. "Why give Saddam another chance? Enough was enough." As far as Cheney was concerned, going to the UN for a new round of weapons inspections was seen by some as a way to avoid war. These included UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, Chief Inspector Blix, a number of would-be allies, some countries on the Security Council, and certain persons in the State Department, including Secretary Powell. As Cheney sarcastically summarized the stance of these professional diplomats, "Wrap the whole thing up in red tape as it's been done for 12 years previously, pass another resolution, call it good, everybody goes home, and nothing happens." None of the other principals, including Rumsfeld and Rice, seemed to agree that the declaration on its face was sufficient grounds to abandon inspections and start the war, and the president agreed with them. They would have to study the nearly 12,000 pages. On the surface, Saddam appeared to be cooperating. It was just what Cheney feared. They were in the inspections business. Rumsfeld's strategy of dribbling out force deployments was working, generating small news accounts and some curiosity, but no big splash. The operating principle was hide in plain sight. Meanwhile, General Franks was steadily improving his position with smaller deployments of generally only hundreds. In early December, he opened a fully operational headquarters in Qatar with some 600 personnel who had recently been dispatched from his Tampa headquarters. In Qatar, Franks oversaw a computer and communications war game called Internal Look that was publicly announced and briefed. "This is not a new exercise," a senior official told reporters in a background briefing. Eternal Look was held in 1990, 1996, and 2000. In fact, however, the war game was the first mission rehearsal for an invasion of Iraq using Frank's hybrid plan. After the four-day exercise, Franks realized he had more work to do. The ground attack through Kuwait was neither fast enough nor coordinated enough, and Franks decided he would run a second rehearsal if time permitted. In his ongoing role as self-appointed special examiner of worst-case scenarios, Cheney had spent a substantial amount of time since 9/11 looking at the potential biological weapon threat to the United States and to U.S. troops overseas. One proposal was to form a kind of medical NASA, a government arm similar to the National Space Agency that could do research and produce vaccines. Cheney thought it so important to protect such a program that the administration should propose a way to structure the funding so it could not be taken away by Congress in later years. Smallpox was a major concern. There was intelligence that indicated that Saddam might want to use the deadly disease as a weapon. Smallpox is particularly fearsome for an unprepared population. Since 1972, the risk of infection was so small that regular vaccines had been discontinued. Cheney felt they had a moral responsibility to do something. If there were a smallpox attack that could have been prevented or alleviated and they had done nothing, he felt it would weigh heavily on their souls. On December 13th, in a 7-minute public announcement, President Bush said that U.S. military personnel and other essential civilians in high-risk areas of the world would receive a smallpox vaccine. As commander-in-chief, he too would get the vaccine. "The vaccinations are a precaution only and not a response to any information concerning imminent danger," he said. What Bush didn't announce was that some 20 million doses of the vaccine would be set aside as a strategic reserve for coalition partners in a war with Iraq. Cheney also won agreement from Bush to request $6 billion for a new research and production effort, to be called Project BioShield, for the production of vaccines and treatments for other biological weapons. There was another problem with the weapons inspections as far as the Bush team was concerned. Blix wanted the CIA at arm's length. The agency provided Blix with information about possible locations of weapons of mass destruction inside Iraq to make the inspections more efficient and increase the likelihood the inspectors would find them. But it was a one-way flow. The CIA had not gained access directly to what Blix was finding and not finding. Therefore, sensitive U.S. intelligence coverage was being conducted on Blix and the weapons inspectors in Iraq because it was critical to the national security that the administration have the best information about what the inspectors were doing. Spying on UN officials and delegates, especially from hostile countries, was a long-time practice. Blix and the other inspectors were foreign nationals and not subject to the anti-eavesdropping provisions that protect most U.S. citizens. The intelligence indicated that Blix was not reporting everything and not doing all the things he maintained he was doing. Some of the principals believed that Blix was a liar. In any case, it looked like the inspections effort was not sufficiently aggressive, would take months or longer, and was likely doomed to fail. The morning of Wednesday, December 18th, President Bush had a private meeting with Spanish President José María Aznar, who supported a military confrontation with Iraq. With Aznar, Bush scoffed at the Iraqi weapons statement. "The declaration is nothing. It's empty. It's a joke. But we will be measured in response." The president added his private thought that included no ambiguity about what he was going to do with Saddam. "At some point, we will conclude enough is enough and take him out. He's a liar and he's no intention of disarming." At CIA headquarters, Saul, who had day-to-day contact with the operatives, including Tim inside Iraq, was growing increasingly concerned about the mixed message the administration was sending. On one hand, Tim and the other case officers were still out on the front recruiting sources with the promise that military action was coming soon. On the other, the president was pursuing diplomatic solutions through the UN and weapons inspections. Saul was sending regular messages to the seventh floor where Tenet resided. "We can sustain this effort up until the end of February," he said at one point. "If you push this much later than that, we're going to get people killed." Saul's two paramilitary teams inside Iraq were wondering, too. It was the most frustrating thing in the world for them. Sitting out on the end of the spear, not knowing when or if this war was going to start. Saul told Tim that he and his team should get out of Iraq for 2 weeks' rest and relaxation during the Christmas holidays, go home and be back at the base in early January. It looked as if the war might start in mid-January, and certainly by God, February, Saul told them. So Tim and his team pulled out for 2 weeks over the holidays. In fact, Saul had no idea when a war might start. The same day Bush met with the Spanish president, December 18th, he met with the National Security Council. The CIA wanted to lay out, a little more dramatically, the problems they were having in recruiting and maintaining sources and agents inside Iraq. The contradictions in the two-track policy were causing a problem. "I know I put you in a difficult position," Bush acknowledged. "I know that this is hard, but this is the course we're on, and we're going to have to keep doing all of these elements at the same time." As she listened at the table, Rice thought this was a part of a coercive diplomacy. The credible threat of force to achieve a diplomatic outcome. There was indeed some dissonance, but carrying out coercive diplomacy meant they had to live with the contradictions. That evening, December 18th, my wife, Elsa Walsh, and I attended a huge White House Christmas party for the media hosted by the president and his wife. The Bushes stood for hours in a receiving line as a photographer snapped pictures with the first couple. When we reached the front of the line, the president remarked that my book, Bush at War, was selling well. "Top of the charts," he said, and asked, "Are you going to do another book?" He then stretched out his arms and indicated with his body language that there might be a story there, that it should be done. "Maybe it will be called More Bush at War," I said. "Let's hope not," Laura Bush said, almost mournfully. A year later, I asked the president about Mrs. Bush's comments. "Yeah," he said. "That reflected her view. Laura understands what it means to go see family members of the deceased. She understands the sadness and the agony that happens to loved ones because of the death on the battlefield. Death anywhere, for that matter. But particularly the death on the battlefield," he went on. "And there is a direct correlation between her husband's decision-making and that death. She knows that, and she knows it's tough. And she also fully anticipated the uproar, the noise, the protestation." "And she told you this?" I asked him. "Not really. She told you that. And probably by telling you, told me," he said, staring hard.
Laura trusts my judgment, and we talked about it some. But of course she didn't want to go to war. I didn't either, for that matter. General Franks briefed the president the next day, December 19th, reporting on the results of the internal look exercise and the latest tweaking of the war plan. Later, Rice asked Tenet and his deputy McLaughlin how strong the case was on weapons of mass destruction and what could be said publicly. McLaughlin had drawn the short straw to make a presentation to the president and the principals. A cautious analyst with 30 years of experience in the agency, he was aware that two streams of information that the CIA had were very different. One stream, its importance not to be overestimated in his opinion, was what the UN inspectors had developed between 1991, after the end of the Gulf War, and 1998, when Saddam had caused the inspectors to withdraw. During that 7-year period, the inspectors had had physical access inside Iraq. Though never acknowledged, the CIA participated in the inspection secretly, provided tips and intelligence, received full briefings from the inspectors, and advised them on how to locate and destroy weapons. During that period, the inspectors had uncovered more weapons of mass destruction than they had anticipated. The second stream of information, obtained since 1998, contained what McLaughlin felt was a dramatically higher level of inference. As he had previously told the principals, the CIA did not have anthrax or chemical weapons samples on hand to prove their case. In preparation for his appearance before the president, McLaughlin examined reams of material. Tenet and McLaughlin went to the Oval Office the morning of Saturday, December 21st. The meeting was for presenting the case on weapons of mass destruction as it might be presented to a jury with top-secret security clearances. There was great expectation. In addition to the president, Cheney, Rice, and Andy Card attended. With some fanfare, McLaughlin stepped up to brief with a series of flip charts. McLaughlin pointed out that components for biological weapons were unaccounted for, as were 3,200 tons of precursor for chemical weapons. Some 6,000 shells were unaccounted for going back to the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. He flipped to a large satellite photo of a test stand for rocket engines. The stand, as they could see, was clearly larger than would be needed for the small engines of missiles with the permitted maximum range of 150 kilometers. Another overhead photo showed scarring of the earth at a facility that had been documented as a chemical weapons facility. The scarring appeared to be an effort to clean up after a transfer or a spill of chemicals, McLaughlin said. McLaughlin also presented accounts from several human sources and defectors about large mobile trailers that these sources said were biological weapons production facilities that could move around to evade inspectors. In his most dramatic example, McLaughlin presented the transcript of an intercepted radio conversation between two Republican Guard officers that he showed on his flip charts. "Remove," the first officer said. "Remove," repeated the second. "Nerve agents, nerve agents. Whenever it comes up." McLaughlin explained that the first officer wanted to make sure any reference to nerve agents in radio instructions was eliminated. If Iraq had no biological material, weapons, or nerve agents, why were these Republican Guard officers discussing it? On nuclear weapons, McLaughlin mentioned that Saddam convened a group of Iraq's main atomic scientists, dubbed the Nuclear Mafia, quite often and spoke to them in terms that implied preparations to resume nuclear weapons research. When McLaughlin concluded, there was a look on the president's face of, "What's this?" and then a brief moment of silence. "Nice try," Bush said. "I don't think this is quite... It's not something that Joe Public would understand or would gain a lot of confidence from." Card was also underwhelmed. The presentation was a flop. Bush turned to Tenet. "I've been told all this intelligence about having WMD, and this is the best we've got?" From the end of one of the couches in the Oval Office, Tenet rose up, threw his arms in the air. "It's a slam dunk case," he said. Bush pressed. George, how confident are you? Tennant, a basketball fan who attended as many home games of his alma mater Georgetown as possible, leaned forward and threw his arms up again. Don't worry, it's a slam dunk.
It was unusual for Tennant to be so certain. From McLaughlin's presentation, Card was worried that there might be no there. But Tennant's double reassurance on the slam dunk was both memorable and comforting.
Cheney could think of no reason to question Tennant's assertion. He was, after all, the head of the CIA and would know the most. The president later recalled that McLaughlin's presentation wouldn't have stood the test of time. But Tennant's reassurance, that was very important.
Needs a lot more work, Bush told Card and Rice. Let's get some people who've actually put together a case for a jury. He wanted some lawyers, prosecutors if need be. They were going to have to go public with something. The president told Tennant several times, make sure no one stretches to make our case.
Rove saw that the president was wired up about Blix. The president knew Rove's attitude toward the Swedes. As the highest-ranking Norwegian-American in the White House, and perhaps the only one, Rove was convinced of the historical duplicity of the Swedes, who had invaded Norway in 1814 and ruled the country until 1905. There was a long-standing grudge, and it was a running joke between the president and Rove. In late December, Rice gave the president another Blix debrief. Not much was getting done. Bush was growing increasingly angry at the process. I'm not so sure this is going to work, he said. Maybe war was the only alternative. What do you think? The president asked Rice. Should we do this? He meant war. He had never before pressed her for her answer. Yes, she said, because it isn't American credibility on the line. It is the credibility of everybody that this gangster can yet again beat the international system. As important as credibility was, she said, credibility should never drive you to do something you shouldn't do. But this was much bigger, she advised, something that should be done. To let this threat in this part of the world play volleyball with the international community this way will come back to haunt us someday. That is the reason to do it. Bush didn't respond. A year later, the president recalled, I was very concerned about the process, that we'd get wrapped up in a process and Saddam Hussein would grow stronger. I was concerned people would focus on not Saddam, not the danger that he posed, not his deception, but focus on the process, and thereby Saddam would be able to kind of skate through once again. He would escape the trap again and would be even stronger, and so there was anxiety about that. He was determined to deal with Saddam and not let him elude them again. I would constantly talk to Condi, Bush recalled. He would get updates on the latest inspections and on Blix. I'm on the phone all times saying, all different times saying, you know, what the heck's going on? There was a lot of stress, the president said. Yeah, I felt stressed. All of the holiday parties at the White House added to the difficulties at the end of 2002. My jaw muscles got so tight. And it was not just because I was smiling and shaking so many hands. There was a lot of tension during that last holiday season. Other than Rice, Bush said he didn't need to ask the principals whether they thought he should go to war. He knew what Cheney thought, and he decided not to ask Powell or Rumsfeld. I could tell what they thought, the president recalled. I didn't need to ask them their opinion about Saddam Hussein or how to deal with Saddam Hussein. If you were sitting where I sit, you could be pretty clear. I think we've got an environment where people feel free to express themselves. Did you ever ask Powell? Did you ever say, would you do this if you were sitting here? I asked. No, the president said. One person not around was Karen Hughes, one of his top advisors and longtime communications director. Hughes, who had resigned the previous summer to return to Texas, probably knew how Bush thought and talked as much as anyone. I asked Karen, the president recalled. She said, if you go to war, exhaust all opportunities to achieve regime change peacefully. And she was right. She actually captured my own sentiments.
Rice went to her aunt's for Christmas, then to the president's ranch in Crawford, the barren Texas plain where she seemed to have spent a significant part of her recent life. On either the Thursday or Friday after New Year's, Rice had a private moment with the president. "This pressure isn't holding together," the president said to her. The effort to get UN inspections on an aggressive track to make Saddam crack was not working. Saddam was getting smarter about how to deal with Blitz. Bush also noted that the anti-war protests in European cities and in the U.S. would fortify Saddam and make him think the U.S. would never invade. "How is this happening?" Bush said. "Saddam is going to get stronger. The United States can't stay in this position while Saddam plays games with the inspectors."
"You have to follow through on your threat," Rice said. "If you're going to carry out coercive diplomacy, you have to live with that decision."
The president was concerned about the CIA assertion that sources and operations would get rolled up if there was too much delay. "Time is not on our side here," Bush said. "Probably going to have to. We're going to have to go to war." In Rice's mind, this was the president's decision on war. He had reached the point of no return. Many questions remained, including when and how to force an endgame. Bush was now enveloped in a contradiction. He had privately decided on war, but publicly he was continuing the diplomacy. It was a world of more dilemmas, dissonance, and hedging. Rove was also flown to Crawford for part of the holiday. He had been quietly working on the confidential plan for Bush's 2004 re-election campaign. Rove said that he expected the campaign to be as close as it was in 2000, that the country was as narrowly divided as it was then. "All things being equal," the president asked, "when would you like to begin?" Rove said he wanted the president to start in February or March of this year and begin the process of raising the money, probably $200 million. "We got a war coming," the president told Rove flatly, "and you're just going to have to wait." The president, back in Washington, met with congressional leaders of both parties on January 8th. "Sometimes it requires a little muscle to secure good diplomacy," he said. "Before I make a decision, I will make that reason known to the Congress and everyone in America." Later, at 5:20 p.m., he met in the residence with Republican leaders only and was more candid. "There's a good chance I'll have to address the nation and commit troops to war. It's clear Saddam Hussein is not disarming. I want the process to work before I ratchet up the noise." On January 9th, Franks came to Washington to give the president the latest on the war plan. The main topic was Turkey, which continued to waffle on whether to allow staging of U.S. combat forces. The delay meant Franks' northern front was off the table. Bush asked Franks, "If Saddam attacked or did something provocative tomorrow, what exactly could be done?" The answer was an almost immediate air attack using the approximately 400 aircraft in the region and 15,000 U.S. forces on the ground in Kuwait. "What's my last decision point?" Bush asked. "When have I finally made a commitment?" "Once you put U.S. special forces on the ground inside Iraq for offensive combat operations," Franks replied. "There would be the planned operations to protect against Scud missile firings and to protect Iraq's southern and northern oil fields." Frank said he would be ready to execute in about 3 weeks. "I'd be ready in early February, but I'd really like the 1st of March," he said. Rumsfeld didn't want to walk into the Oval Office one day and say to the president, "Well, today is the day. From here on, the credibility of our country is at stake and we were putting people in jeopardy." On the other hand, he felt there was a time when the president should not want to walk back, and really could not. Rumsfeld told the president, "There is the penalty for our country and for our relationships, and potentially the lives of some people are at risk if you have to make a decision not to go forward. The only way the damage would be mitigated," he said, "is if there is some very highly visible reason not to go forward, like the capitulation or the departure of Saddam Hussein or something like that." The president was rapidly losing his option of not going to war, Rumsfeld was saying. The president took him aside one day in early January. "Look, we're going to have to do this, I'm afraid," he said. Saddam was diddling them. I don't see how we're going to get him to a position where he will do something in a manner that's consistent with the UN requirements, and we've got to make an assumption that he will not. It was enough of a decision for Rumsfeld. He asked to bring in some key foreign players. The president gave his approval, but pressed Rumsfeld again. When is my last decision point? When your people, Mr. President, look people in the eye and tell them you're going. From their almost daily conversations, Cheney had come to realize that the president had made his decision. One key country that had to be notified and brought along was Saudi Arabia. Cheney wanted personally to communicate a decision to the Saudis. He invited Bandar to his West Wing office on Saturday, January 11, 2003. Rumsfeld and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Richard B. Myers were also there. Bandar considered Rumsfeld the toughest Secretary of Defense the U.S. had ever had, more so than even Cheney. This, in Bandar's estimation, was because Rumsfeld had nothing to lose. He was older, it was his second time in the job, and he already had achieved a great deal. There was a confidence, even an overconfidence, that made him the guy you wanted to lead the charge. One purpose of the meeting was to convince Bandar that U.S. forces would have to be sent through and from Saudi territory into Iraq. Rescue, communication, and refueling support was not going to be enough. The 500 miles of Saudi-Iraqi border were critical. Sitting on the edge of the table, Myers took out a large map labeled Top Secret No Foreign. The No Foreign meant no foreign, classified material not to be seen by any foreign national. Myers explained that the first part of the battle plan would be a massive air bombing campaign over several days that would use 3 to 4 times more explosives than in the 42 days of the Gulf War. A land attack would follow through Kuwait, plus a northern front through Turkey with the 4th Infantry Division, if Turkey approved it. Included was massive use of special forces and intelligence paramilitary teams to secure every place in Iraq from which Saddam could launch a missile or airplane against Saudi Arabia, Jordan, or Israel. The 500-mile Saudi-Iraqi border would have to be covered. Special forces, intelligence teams, and other strikes would have to be launched from there. If there were alternatives, Myers said, they would not be asking the Saudis. Staring intently at the 2x3-foot top-secret map, Bandar, a former Saudi fighter pilot, asked a few questions about air operations. Could he have a copy of the large map so he could brief the Crown Prince? He asked. We'll give you all the information you want, Rumsfeld said. As for the map, he added, I would rather not give it to you, but you can take notes if you want. No, it's not important. Just let me look at it, Bandar said. He tried to take it all in. The large ground thrusts, the location of special forces or intelligence teams all designated on the map. For Bandar, there was no way the Saudis could be directly involved in the war if this was only saber-rattling. You can count on this, Rumsfeld said, pointing to the map. You can take that to the bank. This is going to happen. What is the chance of Saddam surviving this? Bandar asked. Cheney, who had been quiet as usual, replied, Prince Bandar, once we start, Saddam is toast. Back in Cheney's office, Rumsfeld voiced some concern about the vice president's toast remark. Jesus Christ, what was that all about, Dick? I didn't want to leave any doubt in his mind what we're planning to do, Cheney said. The next day, Sunday, Rice called Bandar to invite him to meet with the president the following day, Monday, January 13th. The Europeans and their obstruction were very much on the minds of both Bush and Bandar. France, Germany, and Russia were engaged in a volleyball match in the United Nations, debating the meaning, expectations, and timing of the weapons inspections. All three were urging that Blix be given more time. Those people cannot help and they cannot hurt, Bandar told Bush. They tried to play bigger than they were. The assessment was music to Bush's ears. You got the briefing from Dick, Rummy, and General Myers? The president asked. Yes. Any questions for me? No, Mr. President. That is the message I want you to carry for me to the Crown Prince, Bush said. The message you're taking is mine, Bondar.
That's fine, Mr. President.
Bondar believed it was exactly what Cheney had told Bush to say.
Anything else for me?
No, Mr. President.
Now Bondar could return to Saudi Arabia and brief everything he had seen and heard from Cheney and Rumsfeld to the Crown Prince as if it had come directly from the President.
One of Rice's jobs was, as she called it, to read the secretaries, Powell and Rumsfeld. Since the President had told Rumsfeld about his decision to go to war, he had better tell Powell and fast. Powell was close to Prince Bondar, who was now informed of the decision.
Mr. President, Rice said, if you're getting to a place that you really think this might happen, you need to call Colin in and talk to him.
Powell had the most difficult job of keeping the diplomatic track alive.
Also on Monday, January 13th, Powell and Bush met in the Oval Office. The President was sitting in his regular chair in front of the fireplace, and the secretary was in the chair reserved for the visiting leader or most senior U.S. official. For once, neither Cheney nor Rice was hovering. Bush complimented Powell for his hard work on the diplomatic front. The inspections are not getting us there, the president said, getting down to business. The UN inspectors were just sort of stumbling around, and Saddam was showing no intention of real compliance. I really think I'm going to have to do this. The president said he had made up his mind on war. The U.S. should go to war.
You're sure? Powell asked.
Yes.
It was the assured Bush. His tight, forward-leaning, muscular body language verified his words. It was the Bush of the days following 9/11.
You understand the consequences, Powell said in a half-question.
For nearly 6 months, he had been hammering on this theme, that the United States would be taking down a regime, would have to govern Iraq, and the ripple effect in the Middle East and the world could not be predicted. The run-up to war had sucked nearly all the oxygen from every other issue in foreign relations. War would surely get all the air and attention.
Yeah, I do, the president answered.
You know that you're going to be owning this place, Powell said, reminding Bush of what he had told him at their August 5th dinner. An invasion would mean assuming the hopes, aspirations, and all the troubles of Iraq.
Powell wasn't sure whether Bush had fully understood the meaning and consequences of total ownership.
But I think I have to do this, the president said.
Right, Powell said.
I just want to let you know that, Bush said, making it clear this was not a discussion, but the president informing one of his cabinet members of his decision. The fork in the road had been reached, and Bush had chosen war.
As the only one in Bush's inner circle who was seriously and actively pressing the diplomatic track, Powell figured the president wanted to make sure he would support the war. It was, in some way, a gut check, but Powell didn't feel the president was making a loyalty check. No way on God's earth could he walk away at that point. It would have been an unthinkable act of disloyalty to the president, to Powell's own soldiers' code, to the United States military, and mostly to the several hundred thousand who would be going to war. The kids were the ones who fought, Powell often reminded himself. It had taken Bush a long time to get to this point. It had come after 12 years of Saddam's games after the first Gulf War, more than a year of war planning, 4 months of grueling United Nations diplomacy. It was more than 15 months since 9/11, so it might look like a study in patience. It had not been easy for Powell to buy that patience. He had had to go in and buy it nearly every day, buy it with the vast national security apparatus that surrounded a president, particularly Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the boys over at Defense.
Are you with me on this? The president asked him now.
I think I have to do this. I want you with me.
It was an extraordinary moment. The president was asking, almost imploring his Secretary of State, his most senior cabinet officer, and the most visible administration figure other than himself. There was no salesmanship, just a question. Yes or no, up or down.
I'll do the best I can, Powell answered. Yes, sir, I will support you. I'm with you, Mr. President.
Time to put your war uniform on, the president said to the former general. He could wear his diplomatic hat, that was fine, but things had changed.
He's going to do it, Powell told himself as he left. It was momentous. He had come to realize that this president wasn't one to second-guess himself. He didn't know when Bush reconsidered his decisions, replayed the debates, weighed the arguments. He must, he thought. Powell did it all the time. Maybe late at night, Powell thought. And maybe never? Was it possible? The president spoke so confidently. Powell figured his job was to continue and finish out the diplomatic track. That might be the answer. The president's conclusion was clear. There was no way to avoid war. But the basis for that was Bush's belief that the UN negotiations and inspections were going south. There may be a way to avoid this, Powell said to himself, imagining he still had time, even though Bush had crossed the river. Powell knew diplomatic efforts could give the president a problem because they could make him walk back across the river. His rationalization went as follows. His goal was not to unscrew the presidential decision, it was to play out the diplomatic hand he held. In his mind, he was not doing this against the wishes of his boss, only against his instincts that diplomacy would not work. This distinction between wishes and instincts was a delicate and dangerous game. Yet in all the discussions, meetings, chats, and back and forth, the president had never once asked Powell, "Would you do this? What's your overall advice? The bottom line." Perhaps the president feared the answer. Perhaps Powell feared giving.